You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In an April 2012 speech, then Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke asked why the collapse of the subprime mortgage market had triggered the most severe financial and economic crisis since the Great Depression. Mr. Bernanke is just one of many economists who are still debating what caused the crisis. And joining the debate are economists Atif Mian and Amir Sufi, who have a novel explanation, which they set out in a new book published by the University of Chicago Press called House of Debt, How They and You Caused the Great Recession and How We Can Prevent It from Happening Again. I'm very pleased that it brings Atif Mian, a professor of economics and public policy, at Princeton, to our show. Sorry. Our economists still trying to come up with an explanation for the Great Recession that they could all agree on?
Yes, I think very much so. In fact, if you forget the Great Recession, if you look at the discussions around the Great Depression, which, as you know, happened quite a number of decades ago, economists are still trying to figure out exactly what happened and what were the mistakes that we need to learn from. You mentioned Chairman Bernanke, his own work was a lot of it was on that topic. So certainly, I think there's a great deal of interest in terms of finding out what happened during the Great Recession and what we need to learn about it.
Well, just from the standpoint of raw numbers, how was the Great Recession different? Was it longer, deeper?
Well, Great Recession, if we compare it to typical recessions in the U.S. or other advanced countries, it was different both in the in its depth in terms of how many people were laid off, how much output shrank, but also in terms of its length, how long it lasted. And I think the last piece, which is perhaps the most interesting piece from an academic perspective, is the weak recovery in the aftermath of the Great Recession. And that has led to debates like the debate on secular stagnation and so forth.
What are the major competing explanations for why the crisis led to the Great Recession?
Well, so let me lay out three different hypotheses. The hypothesis that we lay out in the book is obviously one of them, which is the one that focuses on household debt and the rise in household debt and then goes through the mechanisms through which that rise in household debt precipitated the Great Recession and also the depth of it. The other two hypotheses, the second one is what in the book we refer to as the banking view. And that is the hypothesis that by problems in the banking sector that were driven by the initial losses, so think of the Lehman crash, for example, that was the primary cause of the Great Recession because it really led to a reduction in credit supply in the banking system that the economy depends on. So that is the second banking view. And then there is a third view, which sometimes is called kind of the structural view, but also more recently it has been referred to as the view that it's policy uncertainty that has led to these issues, that investment, for example, is held back by businesses because they are not sure exactly what the tax policy is, what the regulation policy is of the government. And so this third hypothesis really puts the blame squarely on polarization in the policy side.
Do most economists prefer one of the accounts that you've described?
As you can imagine, there are camps or debates back and forth. I am a bit hesitant to speak on behalf of most economists, but the angle that we take in the book is that we hope we can convince people is that the way to discriminate between these hypotheses is to look at data, and that is really the only tangible way through which we can resolve this question.
Well, Bernanke identified the collapse of the subprime mortgage market as a key trigger. But he distinguishes triggers from more fundamental vulnerabilities in the financial system, regulation and oversight. So he's a member of that third camp?
I would put him as a member of the second
the
camp,
banking
the
explanation.
Banking explanation. So I would say, I mean, you know, I should, by the way, in fairness, say that, you know, sensible people do put some weight on each of the three hypotheses, including ourselves. But really, I think the key issue is that which one is the more dominant explanation.
And you focus on debt. You say debt is anti-insurance. What does that mean?
So this is one of the key insights to keep in mind as we talk about what is wrong with debt from a macroeconomy perspective. And the key point here is that if you just imagine a very simple example of a homeowner buying a house, let's say a 200,000 house, puts 20% down, so he borrows the remaining $160,000 from the bank. Now, for some reason beyond the control of the homeowner, let's say house prices declined by 20%. What's going to happen? Well, under the assumption that the house prices are going down through no fault of the homeowner, if the concept of insurance would suggest that the homeowner should be insured against this bad luck shock that he or she has received. But in practice, the way debt is structured, the individual, the homeowner, still owes back the $160,000 that he or she borrowed from the bank, even though now the value of the house is exactly $160,000. So in a very real sense, the person has lost everything that they put in the house and still owe the same $160,000 back to the bank.
Years before the financial crisis, Elizabeth Warren was warning about predatory lending practices, and she had in mind all the debt that Americans were assuming. You sound like you have a more specific kind of debt in mind.
Well, first of all, the broader issues that we talk about apply to all kinds of debt, and that should be made clear. Just to give you one quick example, if you think of the European problem, which we think very much parallels the U.S. problem, there, the kind of debt, the mechanisms are very similar, but the kind of debt that is at the heart of the European problem is not only the household debt, but it's also the sovereign debt. One can think of the Greek households borrowing from the Germans through their government. So that's another way of thinking about the same issue. So our definition of debt is broad. However, when we look at this issue historically and also in this specific instance, when we look at what happened in the U.S., the kind of debt empirically that comes out as being most destructive, so to speak, from a macro perspective in terms of precipitating recessions and deepening recessions, it turns out is a private debt that individuals take on, and in particular household debt, which includes mortgage debt, home equity lines of credit, credit card debt.
Now, Canada had no financial crisis and has never had a banking crisis. Has Canada seen a correlation between household debt and recession of the sort that we have in the United States?
So Canada does. You're absolutely right. Canada.
All those European countries did, but our neighbor to the north has escaped.
That's right. I think first it is important to keep in mind that the mortgage market in Canada functions quite differently from the one in the U.S. And in particular, Canada has had higher down payment requirements, for example, and so they have more equity cushion compared to the U.S. That's number one. Number two, the Canada in the time series has lagged behind the U.S. in how they have taken on debt, how households have taken on debt. And more recently, people are actually talking about Canada as a country that can potentially, there may be some warning signs for Canada going forward because, you know, they've kind of continued to increase household debt even as the U.S. was delevering.
So should we have similar policies here?
When you say we...
In the United States.
Yes, absolutely. So on the policy side, we definitely need some major structural changes. It's something we talk about very explicitly in the book as well. And the key insight is to go back to your earlier question about debt being anti-insurance. That is the key problem, and we explain why from a macro perspective. And so it is that issue that needs to be resolved, both in terms of the way we write down our tax laws, but also from a regulation perspective.
My guess is Atif Mian, professor of economics and public policy at Princeton University and co-author with Amir Sufi, professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, book called House of Debt, How They and You Caused the Great Recession and How We Can Prevent It from Happening Again. After the bailout of the banks, many critics said something to the effect that The Bush and Obama administrations had privatized the profits but socialized the costs and risks. Are you arguing that debt homeowners faced, that the debt that the homeowners faced should have been socialized as well by distributing them among the rest of the Americans?
No, not at all, actually. So first of all, we are very much in line with this idea that we have socialized the losses for the private banking sector. This is one big criticism of the banking view in our book. Now, the question is, what should be done about it? So the proposal that we have actually talks about imposing or sharing of the losses between private creditors and private debtors and taking the government out of this relationship between debtors and creditors. So if a contract has more equity-like features between the lender and the creditor, then in the event that there is a big collapse in house prices, for example, it will be the private creditors under our proposal who will bear more of the losses compared to how things are done right now. And so the losses of the debtors will be passed on to the private creditors as opposed to, you know, average citizen or the government.
But don't a lot of Americans blame buyers who took on mortgages that they couldn't rationally have expected to be able to manage for their problem? Do you think your economic explanation has some moral implications, particularly as to who should bear the risk and of large debts?
So first of all, if you look at the title of or the subtitle of our book, right, it says how they and you caused the Great Recession. So in some sense, we are very explicit in terms of, you know, when we talk about putting blame, both parties, lenders as well as the borrowers, are at fault in some sense. But our real view is not as much to take a moral position on which side should bear the risk. Our core argument is really an economic argument, which is to say, for the overall economy, it is much better if, in the event of a downturn, both borrowers and lenders share the downside risk more equitably. So it's an economic argument as opposed to a moral argument.
So would sharing losses between private creditors and debtors give creditors an incentive to select better candidates for loans?
Absolutely. So we go through this logic very clearly in the book. It actually, you know, there's a lot of discussion, for example, on regulation. When people talk about the Fed or other regulators leaning against the wind if they think there are bubbles in the market, for example. Now, we know that it's kind of impossible for the Fed to either make a call or even if they could make a call to actually do something about it. But if there is more equitable sharing on the downside, then the private lenders who always have more information about what's happening in the local market, if they feel there is overstimulation in the local housing market, for example, they themselves, because now they bear the downside risk to some extent, they themselves will hold back. And that will be reflected in the slowdown in private credit automatically. So that's one of the good features of what we propose.
Now, Senator Orrin Hatch once said that millions of Americans are bankrupt or near bankrupt because they run up huge bills and then expect society to pay for them. Critics complain that Americans consume too much. But then we also had an economic boom. Would that economic boom have been possible without the credit expansion that made the housing bubble possible?
So this is a question that we address explicitly in one or two of our papers. And what we show is, first of all, that it is definitely true that this big rise in household debt had an appreciable impact on household consumption and hence the GDP of the economy. However, it should be kept in mind that if the boom is artificial and the borrowing against it is artificial in the sense that quite literally, when you look at the people who borrowed during the 2000s, these were people who actually had declining incomes in many cases. And so clearly those people could not keep on borrowing and consuming at the same rate forever. And once that realization set in, it put in place the mechanism that actually led to the Great Recession. So this idea that this extension of credit in one direction only can somehow lead to these economic booms is just a false notion in the long run perspective.
My guest is Atif Mian. He and Amir Sufi have written a book called House of Debt, How They and You Caused the Great Recession and How We Could Prevent It from Happening Again. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Atif Mian, who is co-author with Amir Sufi of House of Debt, How They and You Caused the Great Recession and How We Can Prevent It from Happening Again. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Professor Mian is a professor of economics and public policy at Princeton University. Income and wealth for most Americans has been weak since the 1970s. If the economy was going to grow, was it necessary to find a way for Americans to spend more?
Well, this is the question of rising inequality since the late 70s is very much connected to the rise in debt and the sort of the consumer-driven boom that we saw in the 2000s.
Financial innovators sought new ways to extend credit to more Americans to keep the boom going.
Yeah, so one concept which is very important we talk about in the book is that the marginal propensity to consume, which is basically how much does a person spend out of a dollar if you were to give him or her that extra dollar, that marginal propensity to consume is not the same across the population. It is very different for people at the very high end of the income distribution, who also, for obvious reasons, tend to be savers on average because they have excess income. They have a much lower propensity to consume. Sometimes we give the example that if you gave Bill Gates an extra $10,000, he's not going to go and buy a new car. But if you gave the same $10,000 to middle or lower middle class, then they're much more likely to spend it in terms of buying a new car or a refrigerator. So because of these differences in marginal propensity to consume, which we show very much is true in the data, the rise in inequality matters for the aggregate economy from an aggregate demand perspective. So if the distribution of extra dollars that the economy is producing, if it is shifting more and more towards people with at the higher end of the income distribution, that will tend to put a downward pressure on aggregate demand because those individuals will try to save those extra dollars as opposed to consume it. So now you're stuck at this position where you somehow have to channel those dollars back into the real economy in terms of people buying cars and so on.
And it's been pointed out that $1 given to somebody who's very poor goes a lot further and actually plays a bigger role in the economy. And yet we seem to be moving in the opposite direction.
Yes. And for a while, the economy tried to push those dollars back to people who are more likely to spend it through the debt market, through the rise in household debt.
But as lenders extended more credit to more risky borrowers, didn't they fear possible losses?
Well, they do, of course, and certainly at some point they did in 2006 in particular. But keep in mind, you know, this goes back to the very definition of debt, that if they are lending based on debt, while they fear the downside, they don't fear it as much as they should because, A, they are protected if they are lending based on collateral like houses and the homeowner has 10-20% stake in the house. They know that that will be lost first before they bear any losses on what they are lending.
Did they think the government would step in if there were serious problems?
Exactly. That is the other piece of the argument, which is that even if they were to bear losses, they have this expectation that the government, one way or the other, would help them.
Well, after Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008, how do you think the government should have acted?
Well, so first of all, we're not trying to argue that the government or the Fed, for that matter, should have done nothing. Absolutely not. We very much support the policies that the Fed took to provide liquidity to the banking sector, to make sure that the payment system keeps functioning. What we think should have been done was there should have been more of an effort to impose losses, A, on the equity holders of these financial institutions, but B, given the size of the losses, also a greater willingness to pass on these losses to the junior creditors of these financial institutions. And the financial institutions did not have to go into bankruptcy in the traditional sense of the word for that to happen. That avenue should have been preferred over just bailing out creditors and also, by implication, equity holders.
Well, your book is coming out right on the heels of Timothy Geithner's book, Stress Test, and in it he writes, "We did save the economy." You agree?
Well, we disagree, and in particular, we disagree on the lack of emphasis that the administration put on the household sector or the household debt problem.
And well, one of the things that people like Geithner say is that nobody saw the crisis coming. Some people did obviously see it. What were the warning signs?
Yes, so some people did see it coming.
And made a lot of money as a result.
That's right. Now, you know, our take on this issue of whether you can legitimately in real time see it coming is that it's a very hard problem, and it's very hard to kind of put the emphasis on the regulators to say, okay, you know, it's your job to kind of see the next one coming. What we propose is in our alternative is that whenever it does come, the system should be such that it can absorb those losses in a healthy manner, and that leads to a change in our financial contracts, that we have financial contracts that have more of a risk sharing or an equity-like feature in them.
Well, why would Geithner, Bernanke, and others have believed that saving the banks would be enough to avert a recession?
We obviously cannot go and look into people's intentions or beliefs at some
level.
Well,
they've written about it.
Right. So I think they have certain assumptions which are just not valid. So to give you one example, this assumption that everyone has the same marginal propensity to consume. So if you actually look at some of the quotes from Mr. Geithner's book, the numbers that he puts in are just not correct. So if you look at the data, it is very clear that if you had saved the indebted households from some of the losses, the kick to the real economy would have been much greater than what Secretary Geithner, for example, assumes in his book.
In a Washington Post op-ed piece, you wrote, "The fact that Secretary Geithner and the Obama administration did not push for debt write-downs more aggressively remains the biggest policy mistake of the Great Recession." Would debt write-downs alone have been sufficient to avert the recession?
Yes. So, again, it comes back to the numbers in terms of, you know, what would have been the consumption response if the underwater debt had been written down. And we do all of that analysis in the book. And at the end of all of that analysis, the benefits that you get, A, from the boost in aggregate demand, because you're giving value to the people who are most responsive in terms of their MPCs to boosting spending. B, you would have prevented foreclosures to a large extent. And that would have prevented the free fall in house prices and the accompanying decline in consumption that naturally follows. And number three, by arresting the fall in consumption, we would have also arrested the fall in employment. And so that vicious feedback cycle would have been blunted. Now, we go through those numbers, and at the end of the day, what it turns out that a more equitable distribution of losses in the Great Recession would have meant that this would have been like a regular normal recession as opposed to what we had in the U.S.
I'm talking with Atif Mian, professor of economics and public policy at Princeton University, co-author with Amir Sufi, professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, of a book called House of Debt, How They and You Caused the Great Recession and How We Can Prevent It from Happening Again. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. You point out that the credit problems, including foreclosures, could have what economists call negative externalities, negative effects on people not directly involved in the foreclosure or bankruptcy. Why does that happen?
So we give an example of Elkhart, Indiana, that's of a plant that produces recreational vehicles. Now, this example is interesting because Indiana never really borrowed as much as the rest of the U.S. So the household debt problem was really not a problem that was driven by Elkhart, Indiana.
Do we have any idea why? Just because the economy was booming there?
Well, one of the reasons is that the borrowing was based on a rise in house prices, and the rise in house prices tended to be much larger in places that had natural restrictions on the expansion of housing supply. So, you know, people like, you know, San Francisco, the Bay Area, which is harder to build places. Places like Texas and Indiana, it's, you know, land is flat, it's very easy to build new housing. And so there was this natural pushback against rise in house prices, and then people did not borrow as much as a result of that. But coming back to your earlier question, even though people in Indiana did not borrow, they were actually one of the first to suffer the consequences of the increase in borrowing in the rest of the U.S. The reason being that recreational vehicles, the stuff that they were producing, that's a durable good. And people, when they can borrow the extra dollar, you know, they are more likely to spend it on those extra kind of luxury items. But on the downside, when they realize that, you know, they overborrowed and they have to cut back on their spending, one of the first things that they cut back on is they're not going to buy that new RV that they were thinking about. And so this plant in Indiana, it saw its sales plummet, starting in 2006 to a scale that they had seen before, and they start laying off workers. So this is just one example of how a cutback in spending in places that did borrow a lot leads to a decline in employment in areas which had nothing to do with that borrowing. So this is just one important example of the connections that the economy has between areas that did borrow a lot and areas that did not, but still suffered the consequences of that increase in borrowing.
Doesn't the success or failure of economic policy depend on what you think the relevant measures of policy successes are? Is the federal government using the right measures to gauge success?
I think the question is not as much about the metric that is used to gauge success. I think all of us would agree that, you know, we want to keep unemployment low. We want to keep the volatility in GDP low. And so in that sense, the gauges we use, the metrics we use are proper. I think the disagreement is more on what mechanisms are important for the rise in unemployment.
Well, the Federal Reserve has a twin mandate to address both inflation and unemployment. Perhaps that causes some difficulty? Is that a problem?
I think in my view, there tends to be an overemphasis on the extent to which the Fed can help. And so even if you put in the Fed's mandate, you know, that we should have full employment all the time, that doesn't mean that the Fed has sufficient tools to be able to do that. And so, for example, if you think of the problem of debt, which is primarily the problem that losses are concentrated on the debt as in the event of a downturn, there is not much that the Fed can do to resolve that problem unless we change the way we write those contracts.
The Obama administration implemented some fiscal stimulus. Was it just not enough, or should it have been directed differently? Christine Romer, who chaired President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, says that the administration underestimated the importance of helping homeowners. But she says you've underestimated the impact of the crisis and the effectiveness of the government's response.
So first of all, we do not criticize the fiscal stimulus at all. I think that is a measure that goes in the right direction. We also agree with the view that in an environment with interest rates close to zero, which are the rates that the government can borrow at, that it makes sense to do the sort of the infrastructure, redoing JFK, that kind of stuff. All of that makes sense. And having seen the kind of the paralysis in Washington over those years and the weakness in spending by the government on these kind of long-run infrastructure projects, I think that has been a downside. We should have done more on that margin. But of course, our emphasis is that equally important, because we could have prevented the downside in the first place if we could have dealt with the household debt problem in a more effective manner.
Well, implementing more stimulus would have been politically impossible, considering the current polarization in Washington. So are some of these problems just simply endemic to the current situation?
Yes, I think part of the issue is, you know, what is feasible in the political, given the political environment that we are in. Coming from the academic side, part of what we are trying to do is lay out what the sources of the problems are, and then hope that the political system works in a direction to solve those problems.
Have changes in law, especially bankruptcy law in recent years, aggravated the problem of concentrating losses on debtors?
So some of those changes before the crisis went in the wrong direction. So if you think of the 2005 bankruptcy, the consumer bankruptcy regulation, which made it more difficult to declare bankruptcy and sort of get rid of some of these bad deaths. That was certainly a piece of legislation that went in the wrong direction. Some of the legislation that has come out since the Great Recession has gone in the right direction. So in particular, one aspect of Dodd-Frank that I like is the living will idea for financial institutions that would make it easier to impose losses on equity holders and creditors of these financial institutions.
Do you think that past problems are just in the policy choices, or do you think there might be institutional problems, for example, in the mandate for the Fed or in the capacity of Congress to interfere politically in economic decisions?
I think the structural or institutional, if you like, problem as I see it is that we should not, as a matter of policy, implicit policy at least, we should not be relying on Congress to decide whether Bank XYZ should be bailed out through TARP or whether homeowners should be bailed out. That's just bad policy from a design perspective, which is why we propose a change in the way we do write financial contracts. Now, that is an area where regulation does come in, and right now it's biased in the wrong direction.
Well, some, like MIT economist Simon Johnson, have criticized the regulatory response to the crisis. Do you think the regulatory response has been adequate?
So, no, and let me be more specific in terms of my criticism of the way regulation is done in the U.S. and other advanced economies, which, in my view, goes in the wrong direction. So instead of helping, it's actually hurting the economy. And in particular,
it is... So you agree with conservatives who say that?
Well, depending on which argument they are making. But the piece which is dangerous in terms of our regulation is that it actually subsidizes debt, precisely what we define as the source of the problem. Regulation subsidizes debt. Let me give you one specific example. The bank capital regulation has this idea of what is referred to as risk-adjusted capital requirements. If you go through the risk adjustment adjusted weights, they actually allow the banks to put up less collateral, less capital, against assets which are considered AAA. Now, these are primarily debt instruments. So if banks issue more debt, they don't have to hold up as much capital as opposed to if they issue more equity-like contracts, which is completely the opposite of what we want from a macro perspective. We should be encouraging banks to issue more equity-like contracts as opposed to traditional debt.
We don't have much time left, but what do you think about the increase in student indebtedness? Is that adding to the problem?
Very much so. And in fact, the problem of student debt is very much connected to the source of the problems in the Great Recession. So if you look at the employment chances of class graduating in 2009, for example, they are entering a job market where the unemployment rate is 18% versus the average unemployment rate of 6% for the traditional graduating class. Now, while they have lower employment opportunities, they have much higher burden of debt through student debt, number one. Number two, student debt actually turns out to be the worst kind of debt to have because it is the most difficult debt to get out of in the event you want to declare bankruptcy, for example. So this is like the most extreme form of anti-insurance that one can think of. And that is going to hurt the economy for exactly the same mechanisms.
House of Debt, how they and you caused the Great Recession and how we can prevent it from happening again, written by Amer Sufi and my guest Atif Mian. It is published by the University of Chicago Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.